ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
People feel like they're doing something rather than just feeling despair when they listen to, you know, the evening news or read on their phone what's happening around the world. They're actually engaging with it, learning about it, and making a difference that way.
Hi, I'm Sabra Lane and this is The Bright Side, the podcast bringing you stories of hope from all across Australia about the problems that people in your community are trying to fix, and that just might inspire you to do the same. In this episode...
That's the most exciting thing about this new approach is the results that we've got for the kids.
Pause, take it all in and appreciate the tiny little details in life.
You don't know what they're going to be, but they happen a lot. Unexpected gestures...
Random acts of kindness and good news that we can hear a lot more of. Ordinary people making a meaningful and powerful difference. Does it sound like you or your intention to make a difference to your community? If the answer is yes, then this segment will probably appeal to you in a very big way. When we hear or see refugee stories, many people think, gosh, I feel so helpless and hopeless. But in Australia right now, there are very practical ways to help refugees settle in when they get here and become members of our community. Everyday people, just like you, are welcoming refugees to Australia and helping them settle here. They're not helping them forever, just for a little while. It's a program that's worked well overseas and has been up and running in Australia for 2 years now. It's known as CRISP, the Community Refugee Integration and Settlement Pilot. It settles refugees here with trained community groups all around Australia to help those with no family ties here to settle down. Lisa Button has worked in refugee law and policy for more than a decade, and she's the Chief Executive of Community Refugee Sponsorship Australia. Lisa, thanks for joining The Bright Side.
Thank you so much for having me, Sabra. It's great to be here.
Can you first start by explaining how the CRISP program actually works?
Yeah, so at its essence, it basically is about a group of five or more everyday Australians who live in the same general geographic area, putting up their hands and saying, we would like to welcome a refugee household to come and live in our community directly from overseas, and we will help them with their initial startup needs and essentially walk the journey of settling into that community over the first 12 months, and hopefully they have relationships that endure long after that. But essentially that's the commitment.
The program now has been up and running in Australia for 2 years. How many refugees have been settled here in that time with community groups? And tell us whereabouts in Australia.
Sure. So, yeah, since we started, just over 400 refugee individuals have arrived in Australia through this program. That's about 97 households. And they've really settled all over the country. We've got groups in every state and territory. Northern Territory is just coming online now. But, you know, the map of where people are settling really looks a lot like the general map of Australia's population. Although the exciting thing for us is that this is happening not only in large cities where, you know, refugees have typically settled, but also in many regional areas. So we have roughly 50% of the refugees coming through this program settling in regional areas as well as, you know, our larger cities.
How many groups are up and running around Australia right now?
We've got about 100 around the country. A few of them have supported more than one family, but yeah, roughly 100. And we want a lot more, I have to say. This whole endeavour relies on more and more people getting involved. So we welcome anyone. And the thing I want to really underscore is that you don't need special skills to do this. If you're a competent adult managing your own life, you've got the skills. And that sense of hopelessness that you talked about earlier on is something that we hear is really addressed through this. People feel like they're doing something rather than just feeling despair when they listen to, you know, the evening news or read on their phone what's happening around the world. They're actually engaging with it, learning about it through their contact with real life people and making a difference that way.
So give us a little snapshot then. What's the reality? A family arrives in a community. Is there government's funding and support, or does that all happen via the community? And that's, you know, basically, how do they survive?
Yeah, look, it's a really sort of shared endeavour. So government puts in, well, first of all, government gets them here and pays for their flights to Australia, and they are eligible as permanent residents for the usual support that other Australians enjoy in terms of, you know, access to Medicare and education and work rights and Centrelink support to the extent that they require it. So that's kind of, that's the government investment. What the group does is puts together some funds to cover their temporary accommodation when they first arrive, just those first few weeks, and provides them with basic household goods. So that can be new goods or quality secondhand items, just the things you need to set up your first home, and helps the family find that long-term housing. There's a few other bells and whistles around all of that in terms of other inputs that the government puts into this, but that's the basic lay of the land in terms of who's responsible for what. So usually groups do some fundraising of anywhere from $5,000 upwards, depending on the size of the household that they're contemplating supporting.
And tell us about some of the families that have come here. They've been waiting for years in temporary settlement countries. When they come to Australia, you know, what has their experience been like? Have the kids been able to go to school? Have they been able to start their own businesses? And, you know, do they feel like this is their new home?
Yeah, what we hear so often is that sense of, oh, you know, finally I'm somewhere safe and I can actually start building something with solid foundations. Seeing how children are thriving in these families has been a really rewarding thing. You know, they're getting into all the activities that Australian children love generally. We see kids getting into nippers and, you know, winning ribbons in their swimming competitions and music and you name it, these kids are getting involved and their parents are right beside them cheering them on. We've seen a number of new businesses established. So that's another dimension of all of this, is that the local group can help the newcomers pursue their entrepreneurial endeavours and also help them into employment. You know, it's often not what you know, it's who you know in terms of getting that first job in Australia. It really helps to have a group of well-connected locals who can leverage their networks. You know, and then there's always the funny anecdotes around our wildlife. One of the families I recall hearing a story that they heard weird thumping noises outside their window. They were staying in a regional area and they thought that there was, you know, prowlers around their property, and it turned out to be kangaroos hopping by in the night. So, you know, you get those sorts of stories as well.
How optimistic are you that this pilot will turn into a fully fledged program? And as you say, I mean, the government has been on the record previously that it would like to see sponsored placements take in at least 5,000 refugees. Is there a timeline on that?
There's no timeline, unfortunately, but from everything I'm witnessing and experiencing, I think it's an absolute no-brainer to continue it and make it a permanent part of our program. So much good comes out of it, both for the refugee households and for the groups. The government is independently evaluating the outcomes and how they compare to how things have happened traditionally in Australia. And while those findings aren't public, I'd be very surprised if this program doesn't stand up very, very well against any sort of reasonable criteria. So the pilot is coming to an end in the middle of next year, but we really want to see it continue as a permanent feature without interruption. You know, once you get the engine of community engagement up and running, once you get that going, you really don't want it to stop and stall and have to start it again. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to keep going and this is only going to get bigger and better as the future unfolds.
Have there been any interactions that you've had that have taken you by surprise or made you feel, oh gosh, I'm so glad that I'm doing this?
So many. One of the things our team has, which I love, is internally we have this thing called the Good News Channel, and we just share little things that happen day to day. And there's just so much serendipity. I introduced a gentleman who was a writer from Perth. He had his own refugee background, to a group that was supporting a refugee family in Sydney. And they had a long chat. He was writing an article about the program. They had a long chat. And at the end of the conversation, this woman said, "Oh, it's all going really well. We just wish we could find an eye surgeon to operate on the grandmother in this family because she's got terrible cataracts. She's almost completely blind and she just can't live life the way that she'd like to or contribute to the family." And he says to her, "Did I happen to tell you I'm also an eye surgeon as well as a writer? And if you can get the family across to Perth, if you get this woman across to Perth, I'll operate on her, you know, in the next few weeks." And lo and behold, that happened. She's now got her sight back, and living a productive life with her family. And it's just those sorts of things happen a lot. You can't plan them. You don't know what they're going to be, but they happen a lot. Unexpected gestures come out of the woodwork quite frequently.
Random acts of kindness and good news that we can hear a lot more of. What a terrific note to end on. Lisa Button, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sabra. And if I could just give a plug, if anyone is interested, please check out our website, refugeesponsorship.org.au, and don't hesitate to get in touch with one of our friendly team if you're interested in being involved.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lisa. And if you want more information, we'll have that in our show notes as well. Let's head to the Churchill Primary School in Victoria's Latrobe Valley. A few years ago, students at the school were really struggling to read, with nearly two-thirds of the Year 5 group failing to meet minimum literacy standards. So the school decided to upend things and take reading back to its basic elements. The ABC's Connor Duffy has more.
I'm going to ask that again. Some people are asleep. What two letters are making our "or" as in "sore" sound? Good job.
At Churchill Primary School, 2 hours outside of Melbourne in the Latrobe Valley, Hayley McColl is teaching her Year 2 class one of the most important lessons they'll get, how to read.
"Or" as in "saw" at the
end of the word.
They'll learn, you know, simple one-syllable words with that sound today, and then the next day they'll be reading it in sentences. The next day they'll be reading it in bigger multi-syllable words as well.
It's a teaching style called structured literacy that's anchored in phonics and involves breaking all of the key components of reading into lessons that are taught explicitly to students. Churchill Primary has had remarkable success since it adopted this method. In 2016, almost half of Year 3 students and 65% of Year 5 students did not meet national minimum standards in reading. Principal Jackie Burrows says within 3 years, every single student met or exceeded the standard.
For us, the most exciting thing about this new approach is the results that we've got for the kids. So the kids are performing much higher academically, but also their engagement, their attitude towards school. Teachers are enjoying teaching a lot more because the kids have been successful.
The new approach replaced a teaching style called whole language, popular on university campuses. Its philosophy is that reading is natural, and it aims to teach partly by empowering students through exposing them to good literature and having them discover reading on their own. Principal Jackie Burrows says this approach was leaving students guessing words, which was frustrating for them and their teachers.
They're not left to discover things for themselves or flounder. They're actually taught explicitly everything that they need to know before they're asked to apply it to anything.
And today, a major report released by the Grattan Institute features Churchill Primary and calls for all of Australia's 10,000 schools to go on a similar journey. The lead author is Dr. Jordana Hunter, who says the science is settled and structured literacy is the superior model.
We need to stop accepting failure. It's not good enough that one in three students are not where they need to be in reading. This is a national tragedy. And as I said, it's a preventable tragedy.
The Grattan Institute says this has a profound personal cost, with students unable to read more likely to drop out of school, be unemployed, or even go to jail. It predicts it will also have a society-wide cost of $40 billion over these students' lifetimes. But not everyone agrees. The Australian Literary Educators Association says whole language can be useful for some students and that it's opposed to one-size-fits-all teaching methods.
That's Connor Duffy. He's reporting there from Latrobe Valley in Victoria. I'll leave a few of his stories in the show notes about how various schools around the country are taking on some bold strategies to get the best results for their students as well as teachers and parents. They're just a few schools. If you're listening and you think, ah, I know a school that's doing things differently too and they're enjoying success, well then get in touch with me. No school is an island, and I'd like to hear how one solution might work for others. That's what this podcast is all about. You can get in touch via The Bright Side at your.abc.net.au. I don't know about you, but when I need to clear my head, I go for an ocean swim, and yes, it's getting cooler here in Tassie, or I go for a hike, and there's nothing better than the smell of eucalyptus and the sound of currawongs or eastern rosellas and the crunch of leaves and branches under your feet. That's me. I love doing that. And sometimes when I'm out in the bush, I like to take a selfie and share it on my social media feeds. Often I'll take photos of things because I'm an awe hunter. I like magical things when you see them, rainbows, birds, even flowers. And in the past year, one Tasmanian bushwalker, well, she took a snap of a flower on her hike and she didn't know it at the time, but she photographed something really, really special, an endangered species of violet that had never been seen on the island before. How amazing is that? And this is also an example of citizen science at work, actually. ABC Hobart's Georgie Burgess actually filed a story about this, and she joins us now on The Bright Side. Welcome, Georgie.
Hi, Sabra. Thanks for having me.
Tell me more about this discovery.
Well, it's incredible, really. So a young woman called Juliet was out for a walk on Ben Lomond, which is this beautiful alpine area in the north of the state, just out of Launceston. She notices this funny-looking tiny flower on the way back down. So she's taken...
It's weeny, like it's...
It's tiny. We're talking like the size of a fingernail. So she's managed to spot that, but it is right on the side of the path.
Yeah.
And so she takes a few photos and, yeah, later logs it on this citizen science platform to say, hey, I found this flower. Does anyone know what it is?
And did anyone answer her?
No, and I think she was expecting to be instantly corrected by, you know, an expert saying, oh, it's this, but... It caught the eye of, a violet expert who said, I've never seen that before. I think we're going to have to come and have a look at this in person. This is a really interesting find.
How did she react when she found out that, she'd found something rare?
Well, I think she was really excited to be a part of something like that. And then she told me she felt quite weird about it as well, that she'd discovered this species that had never been found before in Tasmania. So, she was really chuffed.
It's what's happened since this discovery?
Weirdly, Australia's two violet experts happened to both be in Tasmania over Christmas. And so they went out together to have a look at it with their own eyes, and they got permits to take a collection of this flower to do it properly. And it went back to the herbarium where it's been mounted. And we've had to update our list of flora in Tasmania to now include that we do have this endangered violet here. And its proper listing in other databases has been updated to include that its distribution does include Tasmania.
And Georgie, you mentioned the herbarium. Just tell us about that. Where is it?
So the herbarium is this incredible place that I didn't know existed, and I got to visit it when I was doing this story. So it's in Sandy Bay at the University of Tasmania campus, and it's actually underground, which means they don't have to regulate its temperature because it's got this perfect temperature to keep all these plant specimens correctly. And so there's 300,000 plant specimens in this big underground vault. Some of them have come from Captain Cook's voyages. Some of them are really old. And even just as I was waiting in reception to meet Dr. Miguel, some bushwalkers came in all wet in their raincoats and walking boots with this makeshift sort of flower press to give Miguel some specimens they'd collected from Bruny Island. So, they use newspaper and wood to preserve them. And so I got to watch him press the violets into the form that they'll then live on in the herbarium.
Oh, wow. How'd you feel seeing all of that and seeing the actual vault? I mean, how big is it?
It's quite big. It's like a huge, big library of all these sort of metal drawers and cupboards with just, yeah, thousands of plants. And Miguel's so passionate and he brought some out. He showed me this specimen from that was collected on Cook's voyage and just all these sorts of special plants. So an incredible place.
So our oldest specimen was collected by Banks and Solander during Captain Cook's first voyage. And it's from 1769, so it's gone past its 250-year mark already. When I was in the Madrid Herbarium, I visited some of their collections from the exploration voyages of the Amazon basin, and they were about 500 years old.
This is a really good example of citizen science in action. When it comes to discovering or rediscovering native plants like this, are scientists encouraging people to do this sort of stuff?
They are. When I was talking to Dr. Miguel de Salas about this, he said it's really hard for academics and researchers to be out in the field all the time. They just, they don't have the time to do it. So having boots on the ground, eyes on the ground out there is so helpful for them. And he said he loves getting notifications of entries on platforms like iNaturalist, because it takes him seconds to have a look at it and think, oh no, that's really common, or oh no, that's interesting, thank you for letting me know, or I didn't know that that grew there. So he said it is just really helpful for researchers.
This is a tricky question. It's like, you know, known unknowns kind of thing. Do scientists have any idea about how many plants and flowers they don't know about?
I think there's thousands of plants on the mainland that have never been photographed, and the average person could be helping identify these plants and take photos of them. And iNaturalist is helpful because it uses the GPS coordinates on your phone. You've got the exact time and date, and so you're giving scientists that data. In Tasmania, I believe the figure's down to 46. So who's going to be next to get that figure down to 45?
Yeah, that's an intriguing question. And we're going to stress here, best to take a picture. Don't ever pick a plant because it might be rare and you might be knocking it off. What's the best way for people to help here?
Be observant. Appreciate the tiny little details in life and pause, take it slow on your walk and take it all in. And if you do see something interesting, snap as many photos as you like, because you just never know. You might discover a species that's never been found in your area before.
Awesome. Thank you, Georgie.
Thanks, Sabra.
That's Georgie Burgess, a reporter down at ABC Hobart. You can read her story on the amazing local discovery via the show notes. It might inspire you to take some time to stop next time you're out on a hike and smell the roses or the violets, as this case is, and maybe find a rare species while you're at it. Now, a quick update on a story from last week's episode of The Bright Side. Lauren Cannell shared her personal experience about overcoming chronic pain.
It taught me so much about understanding myself. So I think my life's probably better than what it was before I went through this experience.
She is now a finalist in the Pain Sector Awards as someone who's benefited from innovative pain care. Her experience really moved me, and it's worth listening back to how she found hope when everything seemed so grim. A big congratulations to you, Lauren, on the nomination. My fingers and toes are crossed for the big night. That's it for this episode of The Bright Side and for the podcast for the moment. During the past 5 episodes, we've wanted to test the waters with you to see if there's an appetite for this kind of podcast about solution stories, about fixing things, stories that give us hope. I've loved hearing your feedback over email and on social media and from some of our radio listeners too. It's clear you've all loved it. We all need a bit more brightness in our days, now more than ever. And it's wonderful to be a part of that. Please keep your feedback coming. We'll see if we can turn this into a regular thing. You can get in touch via the Bright Side at your.abc.net.au. I'd love to keep bringing you these stories in one form or another, and I can also send you a link to subscribe to my newsletter, which will continue to come out every fortnight. Thanks for your company these past few weeks. Please stay well, stay hopeful. And there are plenty of people just like you working in your community to make the world a better place. Thanks for joining me on The Bright Side.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.